Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When we are exposed to bright light or when you are not exposed to bright light, that actually determines a lot of our circadian rhythm, how it is in sync with day and night cycle. So for example, many of you may have heard, we need bright light, particularly blue spectrum of light or blue light that goes through our retina or eyes and then activate or synchronizes circadian clock that are present in the base of our brain to the outside world. So that means in the morning, when you wake up, you go outdoor, you get that bright daylight, being outdoor, even on a cloudy day, that's enough for 15 minutes to an hour. That's enough light to synchronize your brain clock with the day-night cycle.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage Podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please, sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear.
Welcome back to another episode of The Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopst, and today's guest is Dr. Sachin Panda. Dr. Panda is a professor at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies and a leading expert in the fields of time-restricted feeding, circadian biology, and circadian rhythm research. Today on the show, we discuss why you should care about your circadian rhythm and the signs that your circadian clock is misaligned, how to optimize your circadian rhythm to improve sleep quality and your overall health, the science of intermittent fasting and proper techniques to fast effectively, the most beneficial times to view light, and when it's best to stop viewing light, the insane benefits of following a well-structured schedule, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going, and welcome Dr. Sachin Panda to the Adversity Advantage Podcast. Sachin, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Thanks so much for taking the time and for coming on. I would love to get right into it. And there's a lot of talk right now about circadian rhythm and circadian biology, and a lot of people, when they talk about it, it's referring to your work and a lot of the research that you've done in your lab. But for people who aren't familiar with it, what is the circadian rhythm and why should people care so much about it in regards to their health?
Yeah, so the word circadian literally means about 24 hours, circa and dian. And so that means that these are the rhythms that happen in our body in every 24 hours. The most obvious one is sleep. Everybody experiences it. So the most obvious circadian rhythm that we experience is sleep, and almost all of us need sleep, and we typically go to bed between say 10 and 12 at night and then try to sleep for several hours. So just like sleep-wake cycle is circadian, similarly almost every aspect of our body function also has rhythm, which is a profound statement, but over the last 25 years, people who study circadian rhythm have found out that almost every hormone in our body, whether it's insulin or growth hormone or anything, any hormone that you can think of has circadian rhythm. So similarly, every brain chemical or neurotransmitter has its own rhythm. And every organ function, whether your gut digesting food or liver using that nutrient or your heart rate, kidney function, even a hair follicle, how our hair grows on our face or other body parts, that also has circadian rhythm. So then the question is, why are these rhythms there and why they are important? One reason why these rhythms are important is by having these rhythms, our body can anticipate and respond appropriately to certain things. The simple example is, if you typically wake up around, say, 7 o'clock without an alarm, that's very important. That means your body is preparing you to wake up by increasing your heart rate, increasing breathing, and slightly a little bit of blood pressure around 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. So preparing your body to wake up. So that's why when you wake up, you're fully energetic and fully functional. And the simple experiment you can do is if you put an alarm clock and try to wake up at 6 o'clock instead of seven, usual seven, then your body is not ready. So that's anticipating you waking up and preparing your body. That's one big aspect. Similarly, when you have your first bite of food in the morning, your body is prepared, anticipating that food. So that's anticipation is one thing. Second is these rhythms help us to synchronize similar activity. Like, for example, when we eat, our gut has to digest the food, and then those nutrients have to be used up in the right way by the liver. So the liver and gut function have to be in sync for a nutrient absorption and utilization. So this is just one example. There are many examples like this to synchronize things that are similar or that depend on each other. And that brings us to another thing that's separate things that are incompatible with each other. So for example, when you sleep or when we sleep, our bowel movement should suppress. Otherwise, you would be sitting in our bed, literally. So this is another example where our digestive system, how bowel movement happens, is completely separated from sleep. So these are many, many examples. So the bottom line is these rhythms help us to stay healthy. And when these rhythms break down, then a body can have increased inflammation or body cannot digest and use the nutrient in the proper way. Or we can accumulate damage, including DNA damage that lead to cancer. Or our brain function is disrupted, so then we feel crappy, depressed, or we have mania or ADHD. There are many types of affective disorders or emotional disorders that can also arise from circadian rhythm disruption.
So would you say that the signs that somebody's circadian rhythm is off is a little bit of what you just mentioned, that they're fatigued, they're depressed, they're constantly feeling off, their body is out of sync? With that said, and somebody's listening to this and they're like, all right, like I've heard a lot about circadian rhythm. Now I understand why it's so important. And now, like, how do I optimize my circadian rhythm so that I can function better? My body can be in sync. Like, if somebody's listening to this and this is their first time familiarizing themselves with this, what are a few steps that somebody can take like right now to begin to optimize their circadian rhythm?
Yeah. So the good news is we all have nearly the same genetic constituent to make this 24-hour rhythm. So there are very few rare individuals who may not have a functional, what we call, clock. But what is more better news is actually there are two very important signals from our environment or from our lifestyle that affect our circadian rhythm. So number one is light. When we are exposed to bright light or when you are not exposed to bright light, that actually determines a lot of our circadian rhythm, how it is in sync with day-night cycle. So for example, many of you may have heard, but those who haven't, that we need bright light, particularly blue spectrum of light or blue light, that goes through our retina or eyes and then activate or synchronizes circadian clock that are present in the base of our brain to the outside world. So that means in the morning, when you wake up, you go outdoor, you get that bright daylight. You don't have to stand under the sun, but just being outdoor, even on a cloudy day, that's enough. For 15 minutes to an hour, that's enough light to synchronize our brain clock with the day-night cycle. So that means those of you who may be waking up in the morning and then you have your curtains and windows all closed and you're getting on jumping into a Zoom call or something, or you're working indoor for the first 6-7 hours or maybe the entire day, then your brain is not getting that bright daylight signal to say that this is daytime. So your circadian rhythm may be thinking that it's still a winter night. He was just living in the night. So that can, so the lack of light in the morning can reduce alertness and make you more depressed or low. So that's why the term winter blue, because in winter time, a lot of people in the extreme latitude, they don't go outside. The converse is also interesting. Late at night, when you are active, you're watching TV or you are glued to your screen, there is enough light, blue light that's coming from your screen or from brightly lit living room or bedroom or all these indoor environments. That amount of light is also super bright to confuse our brain circadian clock. Our brain is thinking that, okay, so this may be just a long summer day, or maybe this is in the middle of the day. So you may not feel sleepy, and that confuses our brain. So light is one. And then the other one that we talk about a lot these days is the eating and fasting. So having meal, particularly breakfast, at a consistent time every single day, tells our body that it's daytime and it's time to eat. So clocks in our gut, our heart, and all these clocks that are present below our brain head, those clocks get the signal that it is daytime and let's start metabolizing food, using nutrient and repairing our body, all that. And similarly, at the end of the day, you need to stop feeding, otherwise the clock gets confused, whether it's in the middle of the day or late afternoon. If you keep on eating, then that clock gets confused. So that's why having, just like for light, having a good bright light, nighttime dim light or darkness is very important for the brain clock. Similarly, eating within a consistent time window, and then fasting every night or without food, staying without food. I won't say actually fasting, because fasting is depriving your body of things that your body actually wants. But here, your body actually needs that rest and rejuvenation. So you're going through that. So the bottom line is, by managing light and managing when you eat or when you fast is the most powerful way to regulate almost hundreds of hormones throughout your brain and body, and also thousands of genes working in different organs to repair, reset, rejuvenate your body, and also to activate pathways that bring you to peak performance throughout the body.
So somebody who's listening to this and now they're understanding the importance of all of this, and they're saying, okay, like, I got to have a good relationship with light. I have to have a great, consistent eating schedule. And they're looking for some specific like protocols. So maybe you could share what you do, like what could be some examples of ways that people could get some light in the morning, or maybe does it have to be outside and getting outdoors? And then on the other side of things, like, how many hours before somebody's getting ready to go to bed should they stop using their cell phones and blue light and turn the lights off in their house and stuff like that?
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about light, what kind of light and how much light. We use our retina, our eye, to look at the outside world. At the same time, almost two decades ago, we discovered that there is another function of the retina that's to sense blue spectrum of light. And why our eye is so designed to sense blue light? Because the richest source of blue light is actually sunlight. So since we evolved on this planet for the last 200,000 years, it makes sense that we have been designed to sense this very daylight, which is the richest source of blue light, to synchronize our brain clock with the outside world. The moonlight and starlights, or firelight, those light give us the ability to see our outside world, but they are not rich source of blue light. So that's why it's a different kind of light, blue light, that's very important for synchronizing our brain clock with the outside world. So then the second thing is, as you can imagine, suppose say our ancestors were in a night where there is a lot of lightning, bright flashes, and those flashes might disrupt our circadian rhythm. So the nature actually designed this. Then they said, well, you know, those occasional flashes are not enough to reset our clock. You need actually continuous light, bright light for 15 minutes to an hour or so. That's the minimum that you need to reset this clock. So it's interesting design that. Okay, so it's designed in a way that there's just the flashes of light in the middle of the night from lightning, or if you have, for example, if you're waking up to go to the bathroom and turning on some dim light, or using your cell phone, for example, to walk to the bathroom, that's not enough to reset your clock. This is very important to remember, because sometimes people say, hey, if I go to the bathroom, is it going to reset the clock? It doesn't. And the second thing that the way it is designed is, you know, wherever you live, it's typical that there will be at least few months, means at least 50 to 100 days, when you may not get full sunlight. It may be overcast day. So that's why it's also designed in a way that even if on a overcast day, or even if you're sitting under a tree in a full, under full sunlight, there is enough light that will, enough bright daylight that will reset our clock if we are outdoor for 1 hour. So this is important to keep in mind. So now you can see that in the morning after waking up, it's very, it's useful to go outdoor at least for 15 minutes to an hour, which can be difficult for most people. So then how can we redesign this habit is, if you have a large window, just get up, open all the window curtains, even if it's winter time, because our idea is, well, we should keep everything closed and privacy and all that stuff. Open the curtains. And then if you have your breakfast, have your breakfast next to a large window. Or suppose if you have a long commute, then you don't have to worry about it, because if you're commuting after sunrise, then even inside the car, your eye is seeing at least 5,000 to 10,000 lux of light if you're not wearing sunglasses. Because if you're wearing sunglasses, then that defeats the purpose of getting enough bright daylight into your eyes. That doesn't mean that you should avoid wearing sunglasses when you're in full sunlight. You should wear them, but at least I'm talking about being inside a car when the when sun is not at the horizon, you still get enough light. So now, coming back to the other side, flip side is in the evening. So although our eyes are not, although this blue light sensing mechanism is not super sensitive, but still what is happening these days is we have, means in the history of human life, only in the past 20 to 40 years, I would say, we have so many glowing objects, whether it's television or it's now cell phone or tablets or laptops. Those glowing objects are very close to our eyes. So that means we are getting a lot of light from these devices. And these devices, which look, even if they're looking white, blank screen, or if you're looking at any images, they do have enough of this blue light that they may be coming in drips. But then if you look at it, stare at it long enough, then that can also disrupt our circadian rhythm. So that's why the idea is you should limit exposure to this bright blue light or bright devices that are bright at least 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. So then the question is, okay, so how we just cannot stop using our devices, then what do we do? So a few rule of thumb is, well, at least avoid going to brightly lit places 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. So those places are drugstore, grocery stores. In those stores, or Walmart, many department stores, retail stores, usually in those stores, the bright blue LED lights that give you this very nice white light, they're very rich in blue light. And if you just spend there 15 minutes to an hour or so, you might experience that you are more alert. And that's why they want you there. They want you to be alert so that you can go and spend more time shopping. So one thing is avoid going to those places. And second, if you're at home, then avoid having this bright blue LED light at home. It means you can either use a dimmer to reduce, make them dim, or you can simply select light sources that are little orange light. So if you go to your purchase this LED light. You can always ask, at least in the US and in many Western countries, the LED lights are now coming in two or three different flavors. And one is a little bit orange color, and you can buy them. And I was just in India, and I couldn't actually find those orange color LEDs. So there are many countries where the only option is blue LED light. And in those cases, be careful. Don't light up your living room or bedroom with this bright blue LED. Then the second thing is almost all cell phones and tablets that do have this night shift or night light feature. So that means you can, when you turn it on and set a time, say for example, 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening, for me it's 9 o'clock in the evening, all these devices will dim down and will also do a spectral shift or change the color of the screen to more like orange color. And that reduces blue light. So these are some of the things that anybody can do to reduce exposure to blue light so that a circadian clock is in trend, and also a nightly hormone melatonin that helps us to sleep also rises, begin to rise 2 to 3 hours before we go to bed, so that when we hit the bed, we already have enough melatonin to help us go to sleep. So this is all about light. And then the other flip side is food. And this is where this popular term intermittent fasting, time ratio eating or fasting, all of these converse. And then the principle there is few things. One is when we eat, there is a strong surge of many hormones, insulin, for example, and also surge of glucose and many nutrients that crank up. And those nutrients and hormones also tell our circadian clock that, hey, this is the beginning of the day when this person actually had the first meal. And why this is important is in the next day, the body should be prepared to get that first bite of food well digested and the nutrient absorbed. Because when we eat, it's a huge, huge process that many organs have to come together to digest that food. Before even we eat, gut has to be prepared to get a rush of food and also rush of acids and digestive enzymes to break down that food. So the body has to prepare for that. Blood circulation also has to redirect itself so that the nutrient get absorbed from the gut and sent to the liver. The liver has to be ready. So all these anticipatory activities are clock regulator or circadian regulated. So that's why having breakfast around the same time, give or take another 30 minutes or total 1 hour window, is very important that our body is prepared to digest and assimilate nutrient. Then at the end of the day, what happens is you may be ending your food, say at 7 o'clock in the evening, although your mouth stopped chewing the food and swallowing it, your stomach actually takes up to 5 hours to digest that food and pass it on to the small intestine, where again, some more nutrient absorption will occur. So that means, although you stopped eating, your stomach is not fasting. It's still full of food for the next 5 hours. And then the question is, well, why can't you eat again after 5 hours when the stomach is empty, or 6 hours? The point is, the stomach also has to repair itself. Just imagine, if you cook something in a bowl, then you got to clean that and wash it and dry it. So similarly, the stomach lining gets damaged during digestion process, and then the stomach lining has to be repaired every night. We're just talking about stomach lining, but many of our organs get damaged, our kidney, our liver, many cells, our body gets damaged a lot during daytime activity, and they have to be repaired. In fact, we recycle almost 40 to 50% of our cells in every few days or months. So that means every day we are recycling a lot of our cells. And that happens when we are resting or when we don't have food in our system. So that's why having you add 5 hours of stomach emptying and then give another 7 to 8 hours of repair. So then you get another around 12 to 16 hours of fasting is enough to give your organs some rest so that they can repair, rejuvenate, and be ready for the next round of food that we'll be eating next day. So this is how the feeding and fasting cycle is important. And then the question is, when should you start eating? When should you stop eating? And how does it relate to the circadian clock? So in this context, we can talk about only two hormones. One is a stress hormone, cortisol. We know that when you get stressed, then there is this stress hormone, cortisol, that goes up. And a lot of us know that the stress hormone is not good. When you have a lot of stress hormone, eating and stress hormones don't go well because our body is not ready or prepared to digest and use that nutrient well. And many of us may not know that the highest amount of stress hormone that we experience is actually within an hour after waking up. It's so high that even for the rest of the day, in the late afternoon, suppose say you go for a 100-meter sprint, still you may not get as much stress hormone as you get just after waking up. So that means we should not be eating right after waking up, within an hour or two of waking up. The second hormone is melatonin. And for most of us, almost all of us, melatonin levels begin to rise 2 to 3 hours before we habitually go to bed. So that means every day, if you're going to bed at, say, 11 o'clock or midnight, then your melatonin levels begin to rise, say, at 8 or 9 o'clock in the evening. And this melatonin, we know that melatonin helps us to sleep. So just like it makes our brain to sleep well, only in the last 10 to 15 years, scientists have figured out that this same melatonin also makes our pancreas to sleep. So that means our pancreas, which is very important for blood glucose regulation, because when we eat, almost every food that we eat has some sugar or carbohydrate that leads to a small spike in blood glucose. And that spike in blood glucose triggers insulin production and release from pancreas. And when melatonin levels begin to rise, it actually slows down pancreas, so that even though it is sensing blood glucose, it's not rushing out insulin, it's just producing insulin in a drip. So as a result, eating late at night, very close to bedtime, can keep our blood glucose level higher for longer time. And just like it takes 2 to 3 hours before we wake up, melatonin levels begin to rise. Similarly, after we wake up, it can take 1 to 2 hours for melatonin levels to go down. And the good news is, actually, in the morning when you're exposed to bright daylight, then that light helps our natural melatonin that our body produces to go down much faster. So that means if you wake up and then go outdoor, take a morning walk, or go, if you have a garden, watch your plants, or take the dog out for a walk, or whatever you're doing in the morning outdoor, that's also accelerating this melatonin to go down. So this combination of this melatonin story and the cortisol or the stress hormone can give you an idea that, yes, it's not ideal time to eat 2 to 3 hours before bedtime or 1 to 2 hours after waking up. So this will help you to figure out how many hours, what is the safe window? So the safe window is somewhere, say, 1 to 2 hours after waking up, up to 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. So that's the safe window within which we can eat. And then some people say, well, I'm not feeling hungry in the morning. Maybe I'll not eat until noon, although I'm waking up at 6 or 7 in the morning. And then some people start eating, say, an hour or two after waking up. And then they say, well, I'm okay. I can control myself. I can stop eating at 6. And they do that. So this is where a lot of questions are still there, whether it's healthier to what is more healthy. Even if you start to, or your target to eat, say, within 8 to 10 hours, and suppose, say, you're waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning, should you start at 8 or 9 in the morning and then count 8 to 10 hours? Or should you wait till, say, noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon and count 8 to 10 hours to eat? Frankly, there is no decisive study in humans that have said that one is better than the other, significantly better than the other. I mean, there are some studies saying one might be slightly better than the other. But here, in the pursuit of perfection, don't try to give up what is good enough for you, because what you can do right now is much better than pursuing for the perfection. There are a few things that we have to keep in mind when we look at this data, because our lab actually does many studies in mice and also in humans. We do have an academic app called My Circadian Clock that is free for anyone to download and use. And when they use, they're actually sharing their useful information with the scientist, and we don't use any identifiable information. We are not using it for marketing or making money or posting any advertisement. But what we are seeing is those who start eating earlier in the day and stop, say, at 6 or 7 in the evening or 8 o'clock in the evening, and then they're going to bed, say, 3 or 4 hours after the last meal, they have slightly different food choices than people who eat, start eating, say, at 12 or 1 in the afternoon and then go till 9 or 10, 11 at night. Because what happens is we are social animals. We tend to eat, many of us, few may be eating alone, but many of us, we eat together. It's in a social setting, whether with your friends or family. And then your chance of consuming alcohol and consuming sugary dessert is much higher if your window is late into the night. And that's what we see in many of our studies. Whereas it's much easier to control because, you know, you cannot drink too much alcohol if you're stopping at 6 o'clock. And even if you have a glass of wine or something, then that's not going to affect your sleep as much as if you had a glass of wine close to your bedtime. And we do see in one specific studies on firefighters, what we found was firefighters who, not all firefighters drink alcohol, but few of them who used to have some beer or wine on off days, not when they're working, to be very clear, on the off days, when they adopt a 10 hours time window and then they stop eating, say, before 8 o'clock, we saw a significant reduction in their alcohol intake. It just helped us. There's not enough time to drink, and they just could not keep drinking till midnight. So this is a good side effect, I could say, that you reduce your alcohol intake and also you reduce your dessert intake, sugar intake, if your window is ending, say, before 8 o'clock in the evening.
There might be people like listening to this and they're like, all right, you know, I've experimented with intermittent fasting, haven't been able to make it work, or I'm trying to be more consistent with my diet and when I eat, but, you know, I'm having a hard time. Or maybe there's people that are already doing these things and trying to take it to the next level. What do you think is more important? Is it the consistency in the time that you eat each and every day, or is it the time you go without food?
Yeah, so as I said, the first bite of the day or the first time you're eating something that has substantial amount of calorie, then that is the biggest trigger for the circadian clock to be synchronized. So that's one important thing. And then the number of hours you're going without food, that helps. But at the same time, we have to keep a few things in mind. So for example, somebody who is a bodybuilder or is a guy who is actually into sports, swimming or anything, so they have to consume a huge amount of food just to sustain that high level of activity. And when they start doing intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, whatever you call it, and they're trying, say, 8 hours, they may not have enough time to consume enough food to sustain that high level of activity. So in that case, 10 hours is good. And in fact, we have seen that in mice and also in humans, once you achieve your optimum health state, if you're even eating within 12 hours consistently and a healthy food, that itself is very beneficial. And here is something that almost everybody says that, well, I eat everything within 12 hours. We actually did an objective study. We asked people to take a picture of every single food or drinks, even water, whatever they're eating or drinking, take a picture of everything. And then we figure out whether it's water or not. We discount those. Or Diet Coke, for example, has less than 5 kilocal of calories. So we discount those ones. And then if we look at food that has more than, say, 5 kilocalorie of energy, then what we find is less than 10% of people consistently eat within the 12 hours window, at least for a week. So you might be thinking that you're eating within 12 hours, but then the occasional snacking that happens outside that window does count. So I would say that almost anyone from 10-year-old to 100-year-old can, if they're having healthy diet, they can still eat within 12 hours if they can control their calories and the quality of food, and they will still be okay. But then if you're trying to improve your health, then try targeting, say, 10 hours to begin with. And then if you still want to reduce weight, of course, if you don't have any other underlying condition, for example, hypoglycemia, type 1 diabetes, other conditions, then you may try to go down to 8 hours. I'll give you an example of like real life situation. I know a friend who is very accomplished person in mid-40s, figured out that he's clinically obese because he was hitting almost BMI of 30, and triglyceride levels were high, cholesterol levels were high, and he had a choice that he could have gone, taken a prescription to lose weight and reduce cholesterol. But then he said, this is almost like giving up the control over my body to some medication. So let me try doing time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting. So he tried. He started with, say, 10 hours time-restricted eating. It took him a couple of weeks just to get used to this habit because, you know, everybody has busy life. And the reason why we are in an unhealthy state is because we have some bad habit, whether eating randomly or eating bad food or anything, for many, many years. The body is used to it. So changing that habit is always difficult. Difficult doesn't mean impossible. Difficult doesn't mean that your body will revolt. If you accept that, yes, if you build that mindset that you are ready to take this toughness, to take this adversity or difficulty for 1 or 2 weeks, your body can also get used to eating within 10 hours. So that's what he did. 10 hours, he went for 2 to 3 months, and then he lost some weight and his triglyceride levels improved a little bit, but then it was not improving as much as he would have anticipated. And then he started, since he felt that he could control the timing of food, the next step for him was, okay, so if I can control timing, I can also control the quality of food that I'm eating. So he switched from random eating of anything to any junk food or anything to actually eating more balanced diet, more fruits and vegetables, more fibers, because that's also important. And within 10 hours, and then he switched to 8 hours. And it helped. Again, he lost a lot of weight, and then triglyceride and cholesterol levels also improved. And then finally he said, well, If I can eat within 8 hours, why not I go to 4 hours? So he actually did 4 hours for a month or two. Of course, he saw a lot of benefits, but at the same time, he became a little cranky. So because his hangriness came up, and it was not good for the family because a lot of conflict. I mean, this is where he said, well, if I were living alone, if I didn't have a family, I would do it, because he was seeing a lot of improvement. But he again dialed back to, say, 6 to 8 hours, and with the right diet, it could completely reverse his high triglyceride, high cholesterol. He's now BMI 25. So he went from BMI 30 to BMI 25. Of course, it was a very long journey, 1 year, 1.5 year to go to lose that much of body weight and improve. But at the same time, during this journey, he also realized he has much better relationship with his food, with his body. And then he realized that he had a lot of joint problem when he had this huge amount of weight. So now the joints are much better. So he started walking and then running. And in fact, now he loves running. So The point is, once you start time-restricted eating, since you're just paying attention to timing, and we know that our lifestyle is quality, quantity, and timing of food or nutrition, physical activity, and sleep. So there are 9 different factors. And the easiest one for many people is to control timing. And once you have control over timing, then you feel it gives you that extra confidence boost that, hey, if I can decide when I should start eating, when I should stop eating, maybe I can decide also what and how much I should eat. And that's something that mindset is something that we see in some people, that they have that mindset, that they can use it. And going through that first step gives them that boost, confidence boost, and also the mindset that they can now work on other aspects. And then once they lose weight, particularly those who start with very heavy weight, they also realize that another benefit of time-restricted eating is actually better sleep. Many people report that they were not sleeping well, and now they're sleeping better. And that makes sense because your stomach is not digesting food when you're sleeping. And when you're digesting food, a blood circulation goes to the stomach to absorb all these nutrients. And blood means warm. So that means your core body temperature is warm and you cannot get good quality sleep. So it makes sense that when they do time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting, they sleep better. So now once you sleep better, then you're more energetic in the morning. Throughout the day, you are also feeling more energetic. And one of the side effects, good side effects of time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting, is reduction in inflammation. And our joints are stiff. We feel pain in our joint because that's a sign of inflammation. And when it goes down, then you're more likely to also take it one step further and say, well, now I can go for a walk. I can go for a run. And even personally, I was 20 pounds heavier than what I am right now. And I know that at that time, like 12 years ago when we started this study, when I saw the mice losing weight and getting more alert, and their endurance almost doubled, their motor coordination improved, then I said, well, I can learn something from my little mice. So I started. And I remember there is a 5-mile track around a lake here, Miramar Lake. I thought that I could never run around Miramar Lake 5 miles because I did have stiff joints and I had some mild joint pain. And then slowly I started walking, and I actually walked 5 miles, Miramar Lake, and then speed walking, and then jogging. And also another thing is, when you start doing this, you also attract people who are like-minded. And this is some social aspect of health, that if we are obese and eating junk food, then you'll attract people or friends who are also overweight and they like junk food and go drink more. And when you become healthier, then you also attract people who are more healthier. So that creates this synergy to improve your health. So when I started running around this lake, then I found other people who were running around the lake, and then they would sign me up for some 5K run or 10 miles run or something like that. So the point is, once you start, once you decide to, once your mindset is to improve your health, then time-restricted eating is one simple thing for many people that they can start, because it's just 2 time that they have to keep in mind when they're starting, when they're stopping. And once they control that, then everything else falls into its right place.
So what I'm hearing you say for the average person, like you mentioned, your friend, you know, had a family and wanted to make sure he was also nourishing his relationships while improving his health. And with that said, like for the person who might have a family, they might have a active social life, busy professional life, they can get a lot of benefit from, like you said, just having that like 8 to 12 hour window in which they eat, eating an hour or two after they wake up, stopping eating a few hours before they go to bed. And then just being consistent with that, from what I understand, will get them a long way, correct?
Yes, that's the first step.
And from there, you mentioned one of the benefits of fasting is reduction in inflammation. You hear a lot about autophagy and other things as it relates to like longevity. Are those benefits due to the fasting in itself, or is it because fasting and time restricted eating, you know, helps you lose weight, and the weight loss is what reduces the inflammation and increases autophagy and stuff like that.
Yeah, so this is an important point that we always think that being healthy is weight loss, which is not necessarily true, because in many of our time-restricted eating studies, which are 12 to 16 weeks typically, because that's how long it takes to see some effect, what we see is there are many people who don't lose weight substantially, but they improve their blood pressure, they improve their blood sugar and cholesterol levels substantially. So weight loss is not necessary to see the impact of time-restricted eating. And the animal experiments are very clear, because that's where we can go and sample many tissues, which is almost impossible to do in human studies. So now coming back to whether the fasting is important or what is going on, since we can do these experiments in animals and can sample different types of tissues at different time of the day, we did a very thorough study. So this is the most thorough study ever done in time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting, where we put mice on time-restricted eating, 9 hours feeding, 15 hours fasting, for very few days, because you don't want to keep the mice on this for a long time, because the benefits can confuse the outcome. And then in every 2 hours, we sampled 22 different brain regions and peripheral organs like heart, liver, kidney, adrenal gland, stomach, you can name anything, we sampled it. And then we looked at each of 20,000 genes that are very similar between human and mice, how they turn on or when they turn on and turn off throughout this 24 hours period. So out of this 24 hours, the mice were eating for 9 hours and fasting for 15 hours. So that means we had multiple time points during the feeding time, multiple time points during the fasting time. So it's massive amount of data, as you can imagine, 20,000 genes, many, many mice, many, many time points. And then we put that into algorithms and analysis pipeline. And then we ask which genes are turning on, what time, whether in the feeding phase or fasting phase. And then we can go back and say, are they related to autophagy? Are they related to DNA repair or proteostasis, how the proteins are folded, or mitochondria function, all of this, any question that you can think of. So now, connecting what you asked with what we found, many people, not all, are familiar with this idea that aging disrupts many things. One is mitochondria function. Mitochondria is the energy producer of our body. So the mitochondria, when their quality goes down, or the numbers go down, or the function is disrupted, then we can age. Then you mentioned autophagy, which is our body's natural recycling process where our cells can eat up damaged parts and then recycle them. And the DNA damage repair, every day we accumulate many mutations in our DNA, and if it is not repaired, then we can get cancer. Similarly, protein or proteostasis, which is proteins make up enzymes, and the enzymes help us to digest food, do many, many things in our body. And those enzymes, you can think of almost, you can take a, the enzymes are almost like lock and key. So if those lock and keys are not properly folded, properly manufactured, then they cannot function well. So this, there are like 9 hallmarks, or now 12 or 13 hallmarks of aging. And what we found was this time-restricted feeding in animals improved or reversed at least 8 to 9 out of these 12 or 13 hallmarks of aging. So that means the autophagy level went up slightly towards the end of the fasting cycle. Similarly, you can imagine that the fat burning also went up towards the end of the fasting cycle, and fat gets burnt or broken down to ketone bodies. So you're people are mad about ketogenesis. So that means time-restricted eating or intermittent fasting naturally boosts, increases ketone level towards the end of the fasting. So you can connect all of this, many of this, to the fasting phase. But what was surprising was many of the repair mechanisms, whether it's DNA damage repair or the protein folding so that our enzymes are healthy, all of these repair mechanisms are actually turned on after the mice ate, which makes sense because repair requires a lot of energy, a lot of building materials. And unless you eat, you cannot spend that time and energy towards repair. I would say that not everything is connected to the fasting phase alone. The fasting followed by feeding creates the right environment for many repair processes to start.
And what about somebody who their schedule changes? Like, I have a lot of parents who listen to my podcast and they're listening to everything that we've been discussing about the circadian rhythm and staying in a consistent schedule and getting exposed to light in the morning and then not being so exposed to it in the evening and everything that we talked about with fasting and time restricted eating. But yet, like, summer comes and kids are home, schedules change, or they maybe are expecting another baby and then that throws a wrench in things. So what's the process like for somebody who maybe their schedule isn't consistent throughout the year? Like, how can they still like optimize and utilize everything that we're talking about?
Yeah, so this is a challenge. Everybody faces that, including me. And the point is, if you try to be consistent, at least during the school year or even during summer, one thing is, if this is a good time for, if you are healthy, if you're following timeless eating or intermittent fasting and all these healthy habits, then it's also good to teach your children all these habits. And this is important because now we are seeing that the children are reporting very high level of anxiety, depression, mental health is really poor among many adolescent and college students. And, you know, we all talk about stress, anxiety, all this stuff, but we don't pay attention to whether these kids are sleeping enough, whether they are getting outdoor, whether they're actually seeing daylight, and whether they are going through this overnight fasting. Because when they're, what we have told our children and what the children are also getting, the message that they're getting is they have to eat constantly for their brain to function. I mean, you see, you go to college campuses and you see people are actually chugging energy drinks in the evening or late at night to keep themselves awake later in the night. Now, what happens? They lose sleep. And there is enough evidence now that losing sleep can trigger depression, anxiety, and many brain disorders. And so I think it's important that we teach all these healthy habits to our children. And you might say that, well, 5-year-old, 10-year-old, they cannot do intermittent fasting. I agree. So that's why I say that they should at least eat within 12 hours to begin with. Because anyway, the children have to sleep for 8 to 9 hours. That almost everybody agrees. And 1 to 2 hours before going to bed, you bathe them. And then even toddlers, you're telling them stories. Or if they're little grown up, they should be reading something or listening to music or quieting down their brain before going to bed. And similarly, after waking up, they should have at least 1 hour before they have breakfast. So everybody, every family should at least, the baseline should be 12 hours without food. And within that 12 hours without food, children up to teenagers should be sleeping, should be in bed for 9 hours. And then the adults can be in bed for 8 hours. So now coming to, yes, when you're expecting a baby, sleep is disrupted. And even after having a baby, 3.5 million women are becoming moms every day in the US. And when they become mom, then of course they have to feed and they have to wake up so many times. And this is where, and they're almost like shift workers. They're actually worse than shift workers because, you know, firefighters, they may be doing 24-hour shift, but they do have days off. The new moms don't get days off. At that time, then the point is, can they at least practice some of the other aspects other than feeding, fasting? For example, exposure to light. There's this idea of postpartum depression. A lot of women go through that. after childbirth. But at the same time, we had to ask, well, are they going through postpartum depression because they're not getting enough exposure to daylight? Because daylight is the best antidepressant. And we know that once you are kind of waking up 3-4 times to take care of the baby at nighttime, then you are really sleepy during daytime, and then you have to do a lot of stuff. And if you're working, then you are just rushing from one thing to another, and you may not get enough time to sleep or to get daylight. So in this case, it's very important to at least have catch-up sleep in the weekend or whenever you have time, and also to get some daylight hour. And so that's why I say, well, don't strive for perfection. Whatever you can do for managing light, managing sleep, managing food, at least one or two of them, anybody can do in any schedule. And when the schedule changes, yes, we have seen that in mice and also in humans. When people do 8 to 10 hours of eating, say, within the week, and then go to 10 to 12 hours in the weekend, they still get many benefits. And so that's why don't just stay fixated that if you eat outside your window for 1 or 2 days, you are out of the island. That's not true. You can still be getting many benefits.
You see a lot of people over the years that have talked about that when you fast, you should wait until lunch or in the afternoon to start your day and quote unquote break your fast. And throughout our discussion, you've mentioned that really it's not the case. Like, for the average person, the most important thing you can do is just pay attention to your eating window and making sure that you're eating an hour or two after you wake up. And along those same lines, a lot of people they refer back to your work when they're saying things like fasting and time-restricted eating. I'm not sure how much you are online and what you see, but are there any misconceptions out there about your work that you see that you're just like, you know what, that's not what my research says?
Well, the thing is, there are many things that we haven't answered. So the question that you posed, like, there are many people who are, quote unquote, they will say they're skipping breakfast, but they're actually having breakfast, say, at noon or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the question is that good or bad? And my answer is yes. We haven't seen a definitive human clinical study that has said that is good or bad. And what we know is this, that our hunger is circadian. So, and then the interesting thing is we don't know why our hunger has a peak in the late afternoon, early evening. So it's true that a lot of people don't feel hungry in the morning because the hunger hormones and the hunger mechanism actually reaches its peak in late afternoon. So that's why a lot of people feel that it's easier for them to skip the early morning meal and delay that until noon or 1 o'clock. And at the same time, what we're finding is these are the people who may be high functioning people who have to go for dinner with business partners, or they have a very active social life. So they have to go eat with somebody, say after 7 or 8 in the evening. So for them, it makes sense that they can start at 12 or 1 or even 2 o'clock and then go till 8 or 9. And what is important in that case is they should give themselves at least 2 to 3 hours between the last meal and when they're going to bed. And in fact, these days, if you look at what time people are going to bed, a lot of us are actually going to bed around 11 or 12. So if you're finishing at 8, you still have solid 2 to 3 hours before going to bed. You have that gap, that's healthy gap between your last meal at bedtime. So I would say there's nothing right or wrong. I would always say in the pursuit of perfection, don't give up what is good enough.
Yeah. No, I just didn't know that, you know, because there is a lot of people, because you're, you know, you are the pioneer in all this stuff, you know, and a lot of people will point back to your research online when they're talking about intermittent fasting and stuff like that. So I was just curious to see if you've seen anything where people might quote your work or quote your lab, but you look at it, you're like, no, that's not exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah, there are a few things, like, for example, there is this one meal a day and then really reducing calorie and doing a lot of physical activity. I know there is a good proportion of people out there who are normal weight to begin with, or they may be slightly overweight, and they're trying to lose a lot of weight, so they're doing time-restricted eating or one meal a day, where they are significantly reducing their calories. It's obvious that you cannot cram like 2,000 plus kilocal in a single meal every single day. And on top of that, if they are physically active, say running 5 miles, they have a Fitbit that's telling, or a wearable that is saying that you should target 5 miles of running. Then what happens is the body can go into, I won't say starvation mode, but a different state where what we call relative energy deficit syndrome, where you're actually spending more energy and eating less. And it's not that you are sedentary, you are actually highly active, almost athletic. In that case, you may experience some neuroendocrine dysfunction. For example, for women, the telltale sign is they can become amenorrheic. They'll lose their menstrual cycle. And that happens in some athletes. And they may have more anxiety and depression. So these are some of the things that people have to pay attention to. Just don't go too extreme where you are doing time-restricted eating, reducing caloric intake, and at the same time increasing your physical activity too much. And for women, premenopausal women, if you're seeing that you are losing your period, then yes, it's better to crank that down and either become less active or eat a little bit more.
Last question I have pertains to sleep. We've talked about sleep throughout the conversation, and I've heard you say that time-restricted eating, getting your circadian rhythm in check, optimizing your relationship with light, all of these things can help improve your quality of sleep. Anything else you'd recommend outside of some of the stuff we talked about today, that if somebody is just really having trouble falling and staying asleep and they're just looking for something quick that maybe they could implement into their daily routine that they could try to pick up on?
Yeah, so another thing that we didn't talk about is caffeine. Whether it's tea, coffee, Diet Coke, energy drinks, even dark chocolate, all of these have chemicals that keep us awake. We are built slightly differently because some people would say, well, I can have a tea before bedtime and then I can still sleep. Of course, you may be still sleeping, but try avoiding caffeine, tea, Diet Coke, or any energy drink, say, 10 hours before your habitual bedtime. Or you can roughly say after your lunchtime, no, or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, no caffeine. And that substantially improves sleep in many, many people. It means there are a lot of people, they always complain about sleep. And then the first thing I ask, when is their last tea or coffee or green tea? Many things that have this active component. So that's one. And then the usual advice that people get, cooler bedroom, and then taking a shower before sleep. Not eating for 2 to 3 hours before bedtime. That's a huge, because, for example, I cannot sleep if I have food right before bedtime. I would sleep, but then I would wake up after some time. So these are the usual stuff. And another thing that people don't talk about is don't sleep with your pets in the same room, because many pets are nocturnal. For example, cats are nocturnal. Dogs have very thin sleep, so they will wake up, they'll wake you up. And snoring partner can be a problem. They can wake you up. So there are so many things that can go wrong when it comes to sleep. Just listen to all these other advice, but caffeine is something that many people don't pay attention to.
What about alcohol?
Yeah, alcohol too. I mean, so alcohol doesn't help you to sleep. Maybe you may fall asleep, but then your sleep quality is really terrible. And then for many people, what I hear is they wake up. If they have alcohol, they may fall asleep, but then after 2 to 3 hours or 4 hours, they wake up. And the quality of sleep is not that good. So anything other than food is not helping you. Whether it's one extreme alcohol, the other extreme is caffeine.
Well, Sachin, I want to thank you so much for your time and for sharing all of your expertise, your research, and your knowledge. I think the audience is going to get a lot out of this. If people want to learn more about your work and your research at your lab, or they want to download the app that you mentioned, or perhaps purchase your books, where do they do that?
Yeah, so I have written at least two books now. One is my the Circadian Code. It has been translated to 12 or 13 different languages now. And then the second one that we published 3 years ago is the Circadian Diabetes Code, so which is focused entirely on managing blood glucose. So those are the two highly popular books. And sometimes I'm active on Twitter. Sorry, I'm too busy with the research there. and then our lab website, mycircadianclock.org, that's where people can download the app or learn more about circadian rhythm.
Awesome. Well, I'll make sure to include the links to that stuff in the show notes. So Sachin, thank you so much once again for coming on.
Thank you, and have a perfect circadian day.
Thank you.